as we have studied along through this this amazing and thought-provoking book of Job, you've noticed. I hope different occasions in which people have said, "If God would only appear, if God would have a seat there."
Pastor,
I'm Bill. Yes,
Pastor Robert.
Good to see you, sir. And if the idea has been, if God would only appear, if God would come and answer our questions, here is what we would ask Him. Here is what we'd want Him to say. And if you think about this for a minute, on the part of Job, what has Job suggested that he would want God to say, or what questions would he want God to answer if God were to appear, if God would respond to him? What kinds of things has Job said that he would demand of God? Okay, John?
What iniquities are you charging against?
All right. One big one. First one is, what iniquities are you charging me with? You remember on one occasion Job has sort of said, here, I'm going to sign my indictment and let God fill it in, and I'm ready to answer. I just want Him to tell me why He's doing all this to me. What iniquities is He charging me with? Anybody else remember anything else that Job wants God to say? Yes.
I kind of do.
All right.
He asked God, because Job was very faithful. He was just so faithful. He did everything that God wanted him to do, and he asked God, why did he take everything? Why is he doing this to me?
All right. So let me make a short list here. What is it you're charging me with, and why are you doing this to me? That's a pretty good summary of what Job has wanted an answer for, wanted God to say, or what he, if God would enter this discussion that's been going on for the first 37 chapters, or at least chapters 3 through 37, those are the things that God wants to know. What about Job's friends? What is it that they want God to say, that they want God to speak up about?
They thought that Job did something wrong.
They did think that. They suggested that he must have done something wrong, or this wouldn't be happening to him. So what if God showed up, and if God would answer Job's demands for him to enter this discussion and explain things, what did Job's friends think that God would say, want God to say?
He was guilty.
All right. They wanted God to enter the picture and show Job his faults, if I can put it that way. I think that's pretty much what they said. What they thought would happen if God showed up and entered the discussion is that Job's hidden failures might now be brought out in the open.
But what did you do wrong?
What did you do? They thought that God would show Job what he did wrong. Now, you have listened in. Those of you who've gotten to be in this class as we've read through this book, having been a part of the class for the time we've been reading these chapters, at this point, if God showed up and you could ask Him, or you could listen to Him, or have Him address something you want Him to address, what would you want God to say? What questions would you expect God to answer here?
I would just kind of like Him to, I guess there's like some of them, why, if you follow Him and you're faithful, can such horrible things be allowed to happen to you?
All right. So, all right. Why, if faithful, if you've done your best, if you're making the effort to be faithful, do these horrible things happen? All right.
Pastor, can I say something?
Yes.
I quit asking why a long time ago.
Okay.
Because it's all God's will. We're not meant to know everything.
All right. But the problem in this book, though, is that something has happened that wasn't God's will. That is, that Satan has done something to Job that happens, that God allows him to inflict, to cause.
Yeah, because the devil got together with God. He said, I can turn him against you. God said, you can do everything but kill him. You know, and the devil tried and tried and tried. Mm-hmm. You know, and he took everything away from him except his wife.
What you're saying is what happens beyond the scenes. It's stuff that Job does not know.
Right, he didn't understand.
And the question I'm asking now is, when you and I listen in on this discussion where God has allowed Satan to try Job as he has, Job has not renounced his integrity as Satan wants him to do, but Job still doesn't know what all has gone on behind the scenes. So I'm trying to bring it to us now. We wonder sometimes, people still wonder, it's a perpetual human problem. Why do horrible things happen to people? Okay, that's one question. Brenda?
My question would be, does that communication still go on between God and Satan? Does Satan still ask, can I test him?
All right. Let me rephrase it a little bit.
I think so.
All right. Is Satan still doing this? Yeah. All right.
Revelation says a chain was put around him.
I think it does. All right, and he's bound with the chain. All right, what else? John?
On the flip side of your first question, why did good things happen to bad people?
All right, we've raised all those questions as we've gone along.
Rain
all right.
Falls on the just
and it does, yeah. on the just and unjust. So how much of this is chance? How much of this happens just because, as Ecclesiastes says, time and chance happens to them all? How far does God's providence go in all of this? All right, now, obviously, I'm putting up here the questions, and the reason I'm doing that, maybe you've quit asking those questions. Maybe you still have those questions. I know a lot of people do because I get asked them a lot and because I ask them a lot. So the reason I want you to see that is to compare what you would expect or hope would happen when God shows up to speak with what does happen when God shows up to speak. How many of these questions does God answer now in chapters 38 through 42? All right, not a single one of them. He does not address the exercise of his sovereignty in one particular realm that we would ask about. And I want you to be watching for what that realm is. He will raise questions that cause Job to have to think about his sovereignty, his rule in certain realms, but he won't address one, and it's almost as if he wants Job to still have the questions when he gets to almost. All right. All right, look at Job 38 now. Elihu, the young man, has been speaking, and the last things that he has said is to Job about the God being clothed with his majesty, and God being almighty, we can't find him out, and God being great in power and justice and righteousness and so forth. And there is a moment of silence, or God interrupts him, or this is the right occasion for it. But in the poem that develops, the Lord answers Job out of the whirlwind. Notice that Job has not, just before this, been asking questions. He's been asking questions earlier, all through the book, But God chooses now to answer them. Look at verses 2 and 3. Out of the whirlwind, I would say that would emphasize that this is a God we can't see, but that He is an awesome God. All right, verses 2 and 3. Brendan, read for us.
Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? I gird up your loins like a man. I will ask you, and you will instruct me.
All right, I want to call your attention first off to verse 3 where it says, gird up your loins like a man. It's interesting to me that the word used is not for the ordinary word for man. It's not the word translated Adam usually. This is the word that refers to man and his strength or a combatant. He wants Job, remember how Job's health is still now? He's been talking about his skin clinging to his bones and him just hanging on by the skin of his teeth and all that. But he's been saying, here I am, if God will come and answer me and all that kind of thing. And now God addresses him in that way. Gird up your loins means to dress yourself for action, to put your armor on. Get ready for the battle if you want to. That's the idea. But what about the God says, I'll question you. Meaning that man is not the only one who can raise questions. You cannot, none of us can claim the right for ourselves to be the only ones in the conversation who ask questions. And we sometimes forget this, especially when we're under pressure. We think that when we're under pressure, everything should be about us. I mean, that is a human habit, isn't it? When we have problems, we think that things are about our problems, and we forget that other people have huge problems too. And I think maybe that's part of this.
Does that mean that some people have it tougher than others?
Well, that's an obvious fact of life in some ways. But the point I'm trying to make is that there are no people who don't have some kinds of problems. Right. All of us do. And what happens is we get involved in our own, and then that's where our questions explode on us. What about verse 2? Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? What do you think that statement means?
Will you say that again?
Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? That's the first thing God says when He answers Job. How is that an answer to Job? That's really what I'm getting at. John?
Is he asking, how are you even asking these questions when you don't even know what you're talking about?
Maybe that's a good paraphrase out of this. The idea is that counsel means someone's decision or someone's knowledge by which he is guiding or ruling something. I think the counsel here would be God's counsel or God's wisdom and how He operates His world. Words without knowledge would mean that there are things going on beyond Job's view that Job does not see. The thing that God is going to be addressing throughout these questions of Job is pressing on Job's mind that there may be things either under the surface or out of view beyond the horizon that Job cannot possibly see. Now, how would that be partly an answer to the dilemma of this book?
Because God does.
All right. Because there was something. For example, Satan appearing before God and claiming that he had the whole world in his hands, and then God allowing him to see if anybody would just worship him because he's God. All right, Job doesn't know that, and God still doesn't tell him. All he's saying is, there may be some things, Job, but you're not aware of here. Okay, Ed?
A good example in the New Testament is Timothy, 1 Timothy 1 and 7, that you don't know what you're talking about.
Yes.
It says, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say, nor the things which they affirm.
All right. That leads to problems, certainly, in trying to come to faith and passing that along to other people, this leads to problems in dealing with personal difficulties and challenges that go on. Now, I want to just kind of mention, without trying to read every verse of this, the questions that get raised. And Brother Feeney mentioned to me after class last week that he thought that these chapters here might be the best commentary on creation, on Genesis chapters 1 and 2 that we have. This might be the closest to that. And just think about the way in which God allows Job to see his own limitations and God's glory here. All right, notice that beginning in verse 4, God deals with what we sometimes call the inanimate world, meaning the natural world made up of things that don't move and don't have necessarily life in them, but the world in which life can exist and can thrive. The first thing that he asks in verse 4 is, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth?" How's that for an opening line? How does that immediately humble Job? What has to be the answer? Unless, you know, Job was not the first man made. And the first man made was not there when God laid the foundation of the earth. What is God's point with this to start with?
He's in control.
All right. There has to be some things Job does not know because he wasn't there. That's right. Have you ever seen people in disagreement over something and they have different opinions or different views? And one of them says to the other one, "I was there. You weren't." You know, that's the idea here. This thought of God's laying the foundation of the earth is mentioned in some other wonderful passages in the Bible. For example, Psalm 102 deals with this. The idea, this doesn't mean that the earth has a footing laid for it somehow or another that's built on a footing like a house. It's a way of saying, though, that planning went into it and that there are principles that undergird it.
When I was in school, they taught that Atlas, was that the Greek god?
Yes.
Held the world up in his hands?
Yes. The mythology held that view of the foundations of the earth. Look at the way God says it here. "Tell me if you have understanding, who determined its measurements?" Have you ever seen somebody getting ready to build a house and they get the, what is the instrument that has the, it's like a tripod, and the transit? Alright, somebody uses the transit to do the elevation and do the measurement of, and so forth, of what it's going to be. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. What? Okay, Becky?
Just to me, this immediately just changes. Everyone's perspective has been focused on Job and
right.
his problems. And God, with that one question, brings it back to a whole different point of view.
All right. That's a very good point, and I think that's right. Notice surely you know, is that sarcasm almost, all right? Or who stretched the line upon it? This is God either with a measuring line or a chalk line or something like that. Who did, or what were its bases sunk, or who laid its cornerstone? And you think there of the footing and then the way the foundation is laid. "When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." Or who shut the sea with the doors? Now, notice that we're talking about earth, or my word would be land here. Who marked out the shores of the sea and all of that? and bursted out from the womb. When I made its clouds its garments and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. You think of somebody being at the shore of an ocean and the tide and the waves coming in and so forth. When you stand there, and if you ever get a chance to stand at the ocean by yourself, right on the edge of the sea, and see the waves coming and so on, you can imagine a man being impressed with the power and the wonder of all of that, and how big and how important do you feel? How strong and powerful do you feel standing there by yourself? Is God belittling Job with this? Is God suggesting that Job's problems are unimportant here? Why would he start the questioning like this?
It goes back to what Becky was
talking about. All right, it does put things in perspective, and it does broaden the horizon beyond just a man with the boils and so forth that he's been dealing with. All right, next. Look, after he mentions the land, I'll kind of make us some... were you there when I laid the foundation of the earth? Notice in verse 12 beginning, he deals with the morning, the dawn. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place? And then these next poetical verses are ways of describing what it's like when the first rays of sunlight begin to spread over the land. Now, most of us, all we're familiar with the sunlight is when it starts showing through our windows in the morning. But look at what he's saying here. And cause the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth, and the wicked be shaken out of it. It's as if the picture is like while the darkness goes on, the deeds of wickedness get performed, and the dawn takes the earth and shakes the dirt off of it, and brings everything to light again. It changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. In other words, now, with the dawn, there's light of life and things are not hidden. All right, next. These are all poetic statements of God's power. So each one, the words could be studied farther. But look at verse 16 now. Here would be the hidden things, the deepest parts of the ocean or the highest parts of the sky. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all of this. So here is I'm going to call it the hidden places, the recesses of the sea, the expanses of the sky, and then the human experiences like death, the gates of death that are beyond our knowledge because we haven't been there yet, you see. That idea, and each of these impresses on Job the possibility that there are things that he does not know. All right, now verse 19. Where is the way to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, that you may discern the path to its home? You know, this is the terrible irony. You know, for you were born then, and great is the number of your days. Have you entered the storehouses of the... Let me stop here and let's put up here sources of light and the place of darkness and where they come from. So this goes beyond the dawn now to the existence of light and darkness themselves.
Almost like he's talking about the measurement of time.
That's right. It would be like the measurement of time. All right, 22 now. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of hail that I've reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed and where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? One of the writers that I've tried to read in preparing for class described this as the arsenal of heaven. The snow, the hail, the thunderstorm, and the light. All right, verse 25, it goes ahead with the picture of storms. Who has cleft the channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on the land where no man is, or the desert in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground sprout with grass? All right, now that continues with the idea of the rain and the, that type of thing. But I'd like you to notice even the idea of the vast places of the earth. And I'm putting it that way because I want you to notice that what God is doing in verses 25 through 27 is pointing out that His providence extends to the vast places of wilderness that Job doesn't even know about. That there is a lot more involved in God's providing for His creation than Job has ever stopped to consider. And John, you mentioned earlier in our class today, where do the good things in the world come from? But that's part of what God is impressing on Job, that Job has been suggesting God's not paying attention, God doesn't know what I'm going through, God is not doing anything about my problem. And God's questions here are designed to say, Job, I sustain with the rain or the dew or the grass or the wind or the snow or any of that, the light, I'm the source of all of that. Dan?
Well, I think we probably touched on it a little bit already, but you know, our view is so narrow. We have such a narrow view of the world, because our world revolves around us. And God is saying to Job, take a look at the big picture, Job. Yeah. This is the big picture.
Yeah.
There's more to the world than just you.
And note that relates to what we've suggested is the point of this book. The point of this book is not just why is there suffering in the world, but it is whether God is great enough for anybody to worship and serve Him just because He's God and not because of what we want to get out of Him. And that may be what the way in which God's expanding the horizons of the discussion here. Verse 28 now, he talks about the rain and the dew. Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? And think about that. Where rain or moisture, where that comes from? Now, you and I know some answers to these kinds of things scientifically, but still think of the wonder of this. We used to sleep outside when it got real hot when I was a kid. We lived in the country, and of course, air conditioning was not even a glint in our eye. So when it got real hot, Grandma let us sleep outside. And we'd wake up in the morning with our pillows and everything out there wet. I remember as a little kid wondering, where does that come from? And that's what, and think about it, living in a desert place. That's what God is asking Job about here. From whose womb did the ice come forth? Who's given birth to the frost of heaven? Notice rain, dew, ice, frost. Verse 30, the waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. How did we come up with a substance that could take all of those forms? Now he looks up to the sky at night, and these are the heavenly, what's the Constellations. Thank you guys for helping with words I can't remember. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth? This next word gets people are not sure which one of the constellations is talking about. Maseroth in their season? Or can you guide the bear with its children? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth? Have you ever seen one of the deals, the charts of the stars, where it rotates, where you can look at it and it rotates and shows exactly where these constellations are going to be in the sky at different times of the year? How are we able to know that?
It just happens.
The idea that God is making is who arranged that kind of order?
He did.
All right, he did. That's the idea. It wasn't Job. God is saying, Job, you think that I'm not in control of anything right now, but my involvement in my world goes from the dew on the grass in the morning to the movement of the great constellations of heaven. I'm in control of all of that, and my providence is key to it. Okay.
One of the things that I get from this is even the dumbest of us. that the hail falls and the thunderstorms come and the rains come. But even the smartest of us can't explain what he's telling us.
Nor control it, can we? Nor control it. That's a great point. And I think that's very much the thought that's here in this section. Can you, now I'm verse 34 now. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Think of all the efforts people have done to make rain. Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Who can tilt the water skins of the heavens? Think of the water skins like he's picturing, like a bottle pouring out rain from the sky. When the dust runs into a mass and the clods stick fast together. In other words, who can do that? Have you ever noticed what great events of man can be put on hold by ordinary acts of weather? I saw the other day some of the storms that hit the east part of the nation, and guys going to work wading water up to their chest in order to get there. You think about that kind of stuff. Verse 39. All right, we stop here for a second. That's what he has had to say about the inanimate world, and I haven't written it all up here, but that gives you an idea of the kinds of things that are there. Now, all of these things, no matter how great or how small they appear, all of them are things that are outside of the control of any man. Some of them are mysteries to us still. They all are obvious events in life that we don't have control over. But God is still God in the midst of this. And he claims in these passages that he is the one not only who brought these things forth, but who controls them now. We'll run out of time, but I want to ask you to notice next that what happens is that God turns his attention to the so-called animate world, the world of animals. And just quickly glance down through this, starting at 39 here, he brings up the different kinds of animals that he provides for. There is, in these two verses here, the lion and the raven. Compare those two creatures to me for a moment.
The lion and the raven?
Yes.
Beast and
the
bird.
All right, the beast and the bird. One of them is the king of the forest, and one of them is the aggravation. this is not the prettiest bird. What man in Job's day would think of feeding a lion? you might end up feeding the lion yourself.
Right.
See? And that's the idea. Can you hunt prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in the thicket? Now, think of what the implication is here. What is God implying there?
God,
he asked Job. All right. That it's not just a big animal running out here and killing a smaller animal and eating it. God is saying, I have organized things, and this is my work. This is a part of my providence. Who provides for the raven its prey when the young ones cry to God for help? And think of the young bird in its nest with its mouth open like this. It's crying to God for help. And God feeds it, he says. And you come to the New Testament. How is this principle used in the New Testament to comfort us?
God will care for the animals, the birds of the air.
All right. That he feeds the birds of the heaven, that's one thing. But how does it go even farther than that?
Not even a sparrow can fall.
All right. Not even a sparrow can fall without his notice. Now, think of what a wonder that is, what a challenge to faith that kind of a claim is, if you think about it. God does these things. Job hasn't even thought about these things, at least to this point, you see. All right, now, look at the animals who are mentioned in chapter 39. The mountain goats. What's the gestation time of a mountain goat, and how on those rocky crags where they might have lived, how can a young one be brought forth and survive? Have you ever driven by the mountain parts of the U.S. and seen mountain goats up there? What I wonder is how can they live up there. Y'all know, even in our part of the country, down at Eureka Springs, when I lived down in that area, there was a story about one day a neighbor's cow fell through a guy's chimney. That's how. I didn't say it was a true story. But how does a mountain goat bring forth its young one like that? Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. Then they go out and don't return to their mothers and so forth. Verse 5 talks about the wild donkey. The wild donkeys were didn't look like they were much kin, apparently, to our donkeys in this world. They lived like wild horses, roamed the wilderness areas, were completely free. That's the point that's made here. But God's question to Job is, who's loosed the bonds of the swift donkey, verse 5, to whom I have given the arid plain for his home? I heard the bell. Notice verse 9, the wild ox, verse 13, the ostrich, verse 19, the horse. Verse 26, the hawk. All of those are creatures that are wild, free, strong, and a puzzle. I learned, for example, of the wild ox's strength, how it would have been beyond anybody's thought. Why is he called wild? Because he's untamed. And he's too strong for a man. The ostrich, I found out the ostrich could run 40 miles an hour or above and just pass the horse and its rider waving at him as it goes by. That's the thought. How'd you like to be overtaken by a big bird like that? That idea. And then he mentions the horse, the hawk, and all of that. And God has dealt, shown his rule of the inanimate world, his rule of the animate world. What realm has he not explained or not addressed here?
Why?
Pardon?
Why is still having a job?
All right, why? God has not said one word about his rule in the moral world, which is what Job has been questioning. God has not explained anything about how or why. He hasn't said a word about what
what the devil had claimed before him, or why Job had been allowed to suffer. How does it relate then? The point is that if God is great enough to manage this world, and if God is great enough to manage this world, then he is great enough to be trusted in this world. You see, that's very much the idea of this part of the book. Now, we didn't do the last part of this justice. We'll come back and deal with a little of it next week. I want to ask you to notice in chapter 40, verses 1 through 5, was Job's response to this sufficient? Job just laid his hand over his mouth. God didn't appear to be satisfied with that. Why? Was Job's response to these points here sufficient? We'll try to see what you think about that next week. Thank you guys for being with us today.